Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is May Day. Workers around the world are calling for better labor conditions, living wages, fully funded services, and more. Greek shipping workers are going on strike for 24 hours over pension and crew sizes. McDonald's workers in the UK are on strike for a £10 per hour wage in solidarity with the Fight for 15 campaign here in the United States. French rail workers have promised rolling strikes through June over privatization. Air France staff are also planning to walk out on certain days this month. And then here in the United States, longshoremen will stage an 8-hour work stoppage along the West Coast to protest police violence and advance worker rights. If no deal is reached, and so far no deal has been reached, Arizona teachers will continue their walkouts, with Oklahoma teachers having just ended their strike earlier in April. And so many other things are happening across the country. On today's Your Call, we are marking May Day by talking about the current state of the labor movement in the United States and the most effective way of organizing. Today, we are joined by Sarah Jaffe, a Nation Institute reporting fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, and social movements. Sarah is author of the book Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. And Sarah Jaffe joins us from New York. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Bill Fletcher, a labor writer and organizer. Bill started his career as a welder and later joined the senior staff at the National AFL-CIO. Bill Fletcher has also served as president of the Trans-Africa Forum and has written several books about labor movements, including Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. And Bill Fletcher joins us on the line from Maryland. Hi, Bill. Welcome back to the show.
I'm really glad to be back. Thanks so much.
Well, it's great to have both of you. You follow these issues and write about them so closely. Why don't we start off by talking about the teacher movement, because it has just taken off. After teachers in West Virginia walked out in late February and then stayed on strike for more than a week, their demand for a 5% raise was met. Teachers' strikes across the country have followed. Oklahoma, a teachers union is calling for the end of a 9-day strike after a raise was approved for teachers, though their demands were not fully met. We've got Arizona, Kentucky schools just reopened. Now, in addition to asking for raises, these teachers want the public to know what an average day is like. They also want the public to know that these schools are not fully funded. Sarah, you have been writing about this, closely following this. What's your analysis of these teacher strikes?
I think what we're seeing now is teachers who have nothing left to lose. They're in falling down school buildings. They have tattered textbooks. And once you see success in West Virginia, it becomes really hard to tell teachers in another state that they should go back to work in the same conditions.
Bill, how do you analyze what we're seeing across the country?
I agree with Sarah, obviously. And I think that what we're seeing is also remarkable courage in the face of a continuing climate of demonizing teachers and the privatization efforts to privatize education. And so there's this spirit that Sarah captured that is saying, we're not going to take this anymore.
Right, because teachers were demonized a couple years ago. The line in the media was, it's so difficult to fire a bad teacher. Someone on Twitter said, isn't it interesting that the charter school and the privatization crowd really hasn't said much about this strike? Sarah, have you seen anyone comment?
Well, you know, they're busy trying to take over the entire school system in Puerto Rico, so I think they have their hands full right now. But it is interesting. The other joke that I saw was that nobody's talking about arming teachers anymore since they've started to go on strike and show up at state capitals, because the arming the teachers was the response in Florida after the shooting in Parkland.
Mm. Well, and speaking of Puerto Rico, in a recent podcast, Sarah, you spoke with teachers in Puerto Rico, and they have been striking against efforts to turn their schools into charters. But this isn't getting that much attention here in the U.S., on the mainland, I should say.
Yeah, we haven't paid that much attention to it. And the thing is that the teachers in Puerto Rico, the teachers that I spoke with, not only have been trying to save their schools from privatization, but they were the ones who sort of went in and cleaned the schools up after the hurricane with their own hands and got them open while the Secretary of Education is saying, oh, we can't open these schools. We're going to have to shut these schools down. They're not open. The teachers are saying, no, we're here. We cleaned the classrooms. We are ready to open. We are ready to teach. We are ready to bring kids in. And they're saying that because the schools aren't open, this is spurring people leaving Puerto Rico and coming to the mainland because their kids have nowhere to go.
Right.
And the kids really need a sense of normalcy after the hurricane that they're not getting. And they certainly won't get if, you know, the entire school system is turned over to privatizers.
What are Puerto Rican teachers saying about what they are seeing in places like West Virginia and Arizona?
You know, I spoke with those teachers at the Labor Notes conference, and they were there talking to teachers from West Virginia, talking to teachers from Oklahoma, from Wisconsin, from Colorado, we should mention, has also had teacher strikes. And they were saying that it was really meaningful to them to be connected to people who are fighting the same things, right? They're fighting the same current of privatization. They're fighting the defunding of their schools. They're fighting attacks over and over again on their unions.
Bill, what are your thoughts about the power of these various teachers connecting? Because teachers are talking about, in Arizona, I was watching a video over the weekend, a couple teachers say they work not two or three extra jobs, but they have four jobs just to make ends meet. And so they don't have that much time to spend on social media to connect with other states, but they are doing that. A number of the teachers that we had on from West Virginia said they're talking to teachers in Arizona and they're talking to teachers even here in California. What about expressing solidarity and sharing tactics? Can you talk about the importance of that?
Well, actually, I want to push the envelope. I think that it's not just important for the teachers to be networking and coordinating their efforts, but this is really a fight for the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a fight to change the narrative that we have been bombarded with since the Reagan years that downplays the importance of a public sector. And I remember when I was working at the AFL-CIO and back in the 90s, and I had a discussion with some teachers, teacher union activists, who were talking about the challenges facing teachers in public education. And I said to them, that's right. And one of the things that means is that we have to unite around defending the public sector. And they looked at me as if I was sort of off from the planet Pluto or something. and I said, no, look, if you think you're going to be able to save public education while the rest of the public sector is being destroyed, I have a bridge for you to buy.
Mm.
And I think that, so one of the things I think that's been remarkable about what we're seeing is that the teacher activists are not fighting special interest fights. They're connecting their fights mm-hmm. to the fight for education and for expanding resources for education. And this is learning a very important lesson from what the Chicago Teachers Union demonstrated a few years ago in their strikes. So I think that that's important. But the other part that has to go beyond this is that we have to raise people's awareness that even with more resources into education, if we continue to downplay the importance of the public space, we'll lose public education.
Mm. Sarah, what would you add to that? Because we're also seeing, for example, Columbia graduate student workers.
Mm-hmm.
They're also striking. According to Gothamist, a couple of weeks ago, they refused to bargain with the graduate workers of the Columbia Union.
Mm-hmm. What we're seeing, you know, on one hand, we're seeing education workers fighting back all over the place. And on the other hand, as Bill said, we're seeing a fight for the public sector. And so Columbia is obviously this incredibly prestigious Ivy League university, but its grad students who do a lot of the teaching for the school are still saying, you know, we are in these conditions where we can barely do our own work. We are not paid enough. We are not treated fairly. And the university, which, you know, prides itself on sort of being a bastion of freedom and independence and liberal thought, is essentially riding out the Trump National Labor Relations Board, hoping that they won't have to negotiate.
Well, let's pull back a little bit here and really talk about where we are today. Bill, I mean, like you said, you worked for the AFL-CIO in the 90s. And the one statistic that comes up when you read about labor unions is that in the mid-50s, a third of Americans belonged to a labor union. Now only about 10% do. And when you really think about how the workforce has drastically changed, what do you think people need to understand? Because, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s, you could go to a trade school. I'm thinking about my dad right now. You could go to a trade school. You could become a union sheet metal worker and make a really good wage. He's retired. He's got a pension. He's got health care. But when you look at where we are today, you know, I think about if my dad were born today, he might be working in a Walmart factory and with no benefits, because one in five jobs in the U.S. is held by a worker under contract. And according to an NPR Marist poll, within a decade, contractors and freelancers who have no benefits could make up half of the workforce. So, Bill, how do you think we should understand, you know, when we talk about labor today, how should we understand it?
The first thing that people have to grapple with is that the United States historically has the most hostile climate towards workers of any of the advanced capitalist countries. Mm-hmm. And this is documented. This is not just a euphemism or something. This is actually the case, that the attitude of employers historically towards workers that want to join or form unions has been one of antipathy. So this has included not simply legal challenges, but violent challenges. You know, utilizing the National Guards, imprisoning workers, putting them in detention camps, which happened in 1934 in several states. So that's one of the things we have to understand. That's the basis. That's the base that we're operating on. The second thing we have to understand is that organized labor made a series of very bad decisions after the late 40s when faced with the Cold War and anti-communism. Much of organized labor freaked out and eliminated some of its most militant, far-reaching, far-thinking leaders, activists, and unions. And they believed that they had arrived at some level of peace in our time. And as a result of that, there was this lack of thinking about the changing workforce, changing technologies, and et cetera, and what that meant, as well as a failure by much of organized labor to grapple with needing to be a social movement as opposed to a trade association. Mm-hmm. And it was at one point that when organized labor was particularly vibrant in the 30s and 40s, it was a movement that spoke for more than the people who happened to be in unions. And we began losing that by the 1950s. So you have this tendency that's been underway for a while. Now, there have been attempts to change that, including in the 1990s, efforts at the National AFL-CIO. But the problem is the attempts at changing just don't go far enough in making the labor movement, organized labor movement, trade union movement, a movement that is perceived and is practically a movement, a broad movement for economic justice and for workers. And it keeps retreating into essentially acting like a special interest. Mm. And that is something that the right wing takes advantage of, and it was something that I think Donald Trump took great advantage of in going after white workers, particularly in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Bill, can you elaborate on that when you say it's acting like a special interest?
So in the 1930s and 1940s, one of the things about labor that was interesting was that it would take up causes beyond itself. It would make broad alliances. There was this a tremendous impact, for example, on Hollywood, a positive impact that was found. And people that could not even join unions identified with unions. What happened with the changes in, with the Cold War and subsequently was a retreat into treating the union as if it was an insurance company or law firm. So there was a downplaying of militancy. There was a virtual abandon of major strategic organizing campaigns. There was an over-reliance on paid staff within unions, so that many union members, instead of seeing the union as their organization, started to look at the union more in a third person. It was something else. It was somebody else's. And you'd call the union, quote-unquote, for help when you had a problem. But if you didn't need help, you didn't call the union. Well, that ended up meaning that the union was essentially this building, this institution that was out there in case you needed it, just like insurance. And that kind of mentality led to a situation where those who were very active in unions frequently were looking at the union as defending the interests of those who happened to be union members, as opposed to being an institution that was fighting for broader justice. Mm-hmm.
Sarah, what would you add to that?
I would just say that it's, I love listening to Bill talk about labor. The thing that I would say about what's happening right now with the teachers is that they are acting like a movement. And I think that's really, really key, because these are teachers in places where the unions have been very weak. The unions are beyond just sort of business unions like Bill was talking about. They're basically lobbying associations. And so what's happened is the workers have basically self-organized and begun acting like a union, begun acting sort of like one big union. And what I called in the New York Times, that I couldn't believe they actually printed, the Newsies rule, which is like, if we strike, then we're a union. And I think that's a really important lesson that the labor movement really needs to look to right now to make forward motion on the gains that the teachers are making right now.
I think, let me just add something quickly to that. I absolutely agree with what Sarah just said. And I would say that at this moment, the example of the teachers' unions becomes especially important given what's happening at the Supreme Court and the possibility that there will be a decision within the next couple of months by the court that will, which is aimed at inhibiting the ability of workers in the public sector to organize and to bargain collectively. It's called the Janus decision. And so much of organized labor is fearful of this and what it could mean, and yet teachers in so-called right-to-work states being states where a worker is not obligated to join a union or to pay anything towards representation. So a climate that's very hostile to unions. It's in those states that these organizations that Sarah just described have just done something remarkable. And so the point is, it can be done, even under adverse conditions.
Bill Fletcher is a labor writer and organizer. He started his career as a welder and then joined the senior staff at the National AFL-CIO. He's also served as president of the Trans-Africa Forum. He's the author of many books, including Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice. We're also joined today by Sarah Jaffe, a Nation Institute reporting fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, and social movements. Sarah is the author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. And today is May Day. Workers around the globe are demanding better labor conditions, living wages, fully funded services, and more. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. How do you analyze today's labor movement? If you have been active in unions for many decades, what are your thoughts about the drastic changes that we have seen? What do you think are some lessons for labor today? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We live in a very changing workforce today. So many people don't know what their schedule is going to be like on a regular basis, so they don't know what their paycheck's going to be like. They don't feel secure in their job. A lot of people are contractors with no retirement and no benefits. So how do you plan for the future? If that's you, what are your thoughts on that? And what are your what do you think about the teacher strikes that we're seeing, farm workers, the fight for 15? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We've got an email from Mike in El Cerrito who says, as a grassroots activist in Berkeley, groups I've been active in have tried many times to join our efforts with labor unions on the Berkeley campus, the Postal Service, municipal workers, and others. In every case, the unions have been dismissive, or in the case of the Postal Service, hostile to our offers to help raise awareness of the importance of organized labor. I've discovered this is far from just my own experience, but I've never heard a good argument for shutting out non-union support. Sarah, what about that?
I mean, the short version is there isn't a good argument, especially in this climate, right, for unions to refuse any support. But I think the point that Bill made earlier, right, about labor sort of focusing in on its own members and acting like its job is to represent the narrow group of people who are part of the union rather than the entire working class, is really to blame for that.
What do you think, Bill?
I think in addition to what Sarah just said, that we really still live in the with the legacy of anti-communism. And one of the things that happened after the attacks on unions in the 1940s was that to be identified as a communist, there were many examples that were used by the right wing. So one was your attitude towards racial equality. If you were very fervent in fighting for racial equality, you had to have been a communist. If you were engaged in criticizing U.S. foreign policy, you had to have been a communist. If you were engaged in solidarity actions with other workers and other social movements, you had to be a communist. And therefore, there was certain culture that developed and spread within the union movement that said this is not what we should do. In fact, what we should do is stay true to the precepts of Samuel Gompers, the first president of the American Federation of Labor, who enunciated these ideas that were called came to be called pure and simple trade unionism or bread and butter trade unionism. That is, that unions existed to fight for wages, hours, and working conditions. That was it. Thank you very much. And so what this writer indicated to you is that they encountered pure and simple trade unionism.
Sarah?
No, I think that's entirely correct, and I think it's a shame. And one of the things that's interesting right now is that I think we're seeing the rise of a generation that is coming out from under the sort of anti-communism as national religion. And so you're seeing growing numbers of young people identifying as socialists, as saying that capitalism is done. The New York Times ran a piece this week that said Karl Marx was right. It's a new day in a lot of ways. And the labor movement, in some cases, is struggling to catch up.
Sarah Jaffe is a Nation Institute reporting fellow and an independent journalist. She's author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Bill Fletcher is a labor writer and an organizer. He joined the senior staff at the National AFL-CIO after a career as a welder. He's the author of many books, including Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor, and A New Path Toward Social Justice. On today's Your Call, we are marking May Day. Workers around the world are calling for better labor conditions, living wages, fully funded services, and more. According to a report on unions and inequality by Harvard professor Bruce Western, from 1973 to 2000, private sector union membership in the United States declined from 34% to 8% for men, 16% to 6% for women. During this period, inequality in hourly wages increased by over 40%. Today, we're talking about labor movements and the most effective form of organizing. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on today's Your Call on the phone by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington with Joshua Johnson. Today's topic, how safe is your drinking water? A surprising number of communities in this country are not aware of the quality of their drinking water. Learn more at 1A.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with former investment banker Nomi Prinz about her new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She argues that since the global financial crisis, big banks have massively profited from access to cheap money. She's now an investigative journalist, and she says that the Federal Reserve has colluded on a grand scale with banks. She's calling it a heist that enables the most powerful banks and central bankers to run the world. We'll talk with her about her new book. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about a new documentary about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@klw.org. Today, we're marking May Day. And if you have any questions or comments, if you'd like to talk about what you've seen, what strikes you about how the labor force has changed, about the differences between unions of the past and today, what lessons can be learned, what changes do you want to see? Because we just cannot continue down this path. I was just reading a piece today about how one-third of American households cannot afford food, shelter, or medical care. This is according to Market Watch and their State of the American Wallet. One-third of American households cannot afford food, shelter, or medical care. And as we've heard, so many people who are working a couple of jobs have to rely on a food bank or assistance just to get by. Today, we're joined by Sarah Jaffe, Nation Institute Reporting Fellow and author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Bill Fletcher is a labor writer and organizer, author of Solidarity Divided. And let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hi. This is a wonderful, wonderful show. Thank you. Bill Fletcher is a great hero. I'm a proud member of SEIU. And we have had Bill Fletcher speak to our convention several times, and he's just marvelous. And I wanted to just elaborate a little more about the Janus decision. The essence of the Janus decision is to change public employee unions across the country from closed union shops to a right to work or open shops where you don't have to pay for your representation, as he said. And what I wanted to emphasize is the solution to this. It's very, very simple. Don't allow this attempt to bankrupt and decertify, which means remove, public employee unions. Don't allow this to succeed. All you have to do is don't abandon your union, stay in your union, stay a member after you don't have to pay, and keep paying your dues. And the one more point I wanted to make is that while we're talking about workers, we should also end prison labor, which is another whole topic. But if you want to learn a little about that, you should see the movie 13th, and also the Bayview newspaper covers that really, really well.
Thank you so much. We'll add that to our show idea, Judy. What about that solution, Bill Fletcher?
Well, I want to thank Judy, obviously. Let me just look at this issue of Janus for a little bit more. See, the thing is that what many people may not realize, in the public sector, union membership is not obligatory. But there is something that's called an agency fee. The agency fee is basically where someone, if they choose not to join the union because they don't like unions or whatever, nevertheless pay a fee to cover the cost of representation. And it's a very simple concept. One way to think about it is that, can you imagine any city, town, county in the United States where taxation would be voluntary, yet you would be guaranteed free water, sewer, education, police, and fire? It doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so the basic idea of agency fee is to cover the costs. The people that are attacking this are aiming to weaken the ability of unions to operate, and they're trying to play to greed. Their objective is to get workers to say, oh, well, if I don't have to pay, somebody else will pay, and therefore I save money. But obviously this becomes a very slippery slope. And so in addition to what Judy was saying, there needs to be intense organizing of the members, and I think that there needs to be self-criticism on the part of a lot of the unions, which frequently took the members for granted and did not pay enough attention to the concerns that the workers had. And so now we pay a price. So I think that it would be useful for some self-criticism, and that may convince people that there's actually some lessons that have been learned.
Sarah, when you talk to workers, what are the criticisms they have about unions?
I mean, I would say that the criticisms that workers have when they have them are very similar to this, right? People say, I don't know what the union does. I don't know what the union does for me. What we've seen in places like West Virginia after the strike is that workers who weren't members of the union, because not only, again, in West Virginia, not only are they not required to pay agency fees, but they don't have collective bargaining. So teachers who signed up to be a member of one or the other union were basically doing it entirely by choice. They don't have a bargaining agreement at all. And after the strike, suddenly you see more and more workers realizing that the union is them. The union is something that they should be proud to be a member of. And that kind of thing, there's sort of nothing like that to prove to people what the union is and why they should contribute something of their hard-earned money to it.
And thank you for calling in again. We will definitely follow Janice. There's also a really good piece on Janice at In These Times by Mary Batari. And she writes about how this case has been made possible by a network of right-wing billionaires, think tanks, and corporations. So thank you for that. Bill, talking about workers criticizing unions, what about the role of the Democratic Party here and the close connection between union bosses and the Democrats? There have been a lot of stories in the last year, especially after the election, about how Democrats have really paid a massive price for letting unions die. This piece is in New York Magazine by Eric Levitz.
Well, yes. Well, first of all, I don't use the term union bosses. There are union leaders. I'll leave that. We can discuss that on another program. I would say that the connection, the issue with the Democratic Party is a historic question in the sense that the Democratic Party had a relationship with white workers in the northern part of the United States from basically right after the Civil War. And that translated into a certain relationship with organized labor in the first decades of the 20th century. The fundamental problem is not the Democratic Party. The fundamental problem is that the leadership of organized labor, under the ideology of Samuel Gompers, abandoned the idea that workers need to express their own interests as workers. And so in the late 1800s, that included at that time the abandoning of the idea of a labor party. And since then, and particularly since the 1950s, it's been an idea that the role of labor is, again, as a special interest, pushing its ideas, its institutional concerns within the Democratic Party, and then serving as people say frequently, an ATM for the Democratic Party. So instead of aligning with other social movements that are progressive, that share with us many common beliefs and values, and pushing for that both inside and outside of the Democratic Party, you have this mad dash to follow whatever the Democratic National Committee says. And that's what you ended up seeing in 2016 in the lead up to the nomination of Hillary Clinton. That instead of the unions having broad debates about where we should go and who to endorse, including letting people debate Trump, as much as I think he's hideous, but at least having that debate, instead of that, there were a number of unions, including some large unions, that jumped out there and, in my opinion, conducted a premature endorsement of Hillary Clinton, thereby ticking off a lot of their members and setting themselves up for after the November election when Trump was elected. Many of these unions had not a clue what to do. They didn't know what to do because they hadn't had any debates.
Sarah, what would you add?
I agree with Bill, unsurprisingly. I live here in New York State, where we're in the middle of a governor's race, and Andrew Cuomo, who is running for election for the second re-election for the second time, has once again essentially threatened unions and community groups about endorsing him. And the interesting thing that happened this time is that some of them actually broke with him, and some of them actually endorsed Cynthia Nixon, who's challenging him. What we saw here again is sort of the same thing that happened in 2016 with Hillary Clinton, the same thing that happened in 2014, the last time Andrew Cuomo ran for re-election, which is that a lot of unions say, well, this is who we're going to have to deal with. This is, you know, who's probably going to win. He's got the most money. He's got the most institutional connections within the Democratic Party. And also added to that, Andrew Cuomo is a very, very vindictive politician. And so if we don't support him, he will probably try to take revenge. And they endorsed him, again, very early in the process, before Cynthia Nixon had really even started her run. And it's almost like, you know, it's frustrating to see the same thing happen after the lessons of 2016.
The Working Families Party endorsed Cynthia Nixon. How significant is that?
They did. It was very significant in that Andrew Cuomo essentially threatened the unions that are the main backers of the Working Families Party and got them to either pull out completely or at least not show up at the state committee meeting where the party voted to endorse Cynthia Nixon. Hmm. And that is continuing the process that Cuomo began in 2014, pulling unions out of the party. And so, I mean, it's a much broader discussion we could have about the Working Families Party and the way that its national strategy has changed. But it is finally interesting to see them pull back from feeling sort of wedded to Andrew Cuomo and the structure of the New York State governor's race.
Sarah Jaffe is an independent journalist covering labor and social movements. Bill Fletcher is a labor writer and organizer. And on today's Your Call, we are marking May Day by talking about the state of the labor movement and effective organizing. And let's go next to Karen in San Francisco. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guests first their thoughts about the sort of the big context of how technology is changing social communication. And what brings this to my mind is that having read Fred Glass's book on labor history in California, I noted that in the 50s and 60s, as the labor movement was losing power, was the time, and the labor movements in the 30s and 40s had been a real locus of where people socialized with each other and talked to each other and had a lot of communication worker to worker. Whereas in the 50s and 60s, they started staying home and watching television. Many of them moved out to suburbs and, you know, used cars. And it, and the social aspect of the labor movement diminished at that point. Well, now we're in a time where the whole way in which people relate to each other socially is changing again because of technology. And I know this is a big subject, but I'd like to hear their thoughts on both the opportunities and the risks as both labor proponents and also the opponents of organized labor look at using social media and other tools.
Yeah, it's a very important question. Thank you, Karen. Sarah, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because it really is true that the institutions, not just labor unions, but a lot of the institutions that working people used to have to relate to each other, to sort of, I like to say, like to be political together in public, are just gone. And so That's not just a problem of the labor movement, but it is a particular problem of the labor movement. And one of the things, again, that we see in these strikes, that we see in big protests, that we see on days like May Day, where I'm going to go from the studio here down to Union Square, where there will be a march, is that people are looking for those places to come together and to figure out how to be political and public together again. And there's nothing like a big strike where everybody gathers at the state capitol to do that, right? Mm-hmm. But also that the teachers in West Virginia, in Arizona, you know, the teacher that I spoke with from Arizona was the one who had founded the Facebook group that became Arizona Educators United, that is one of the real forces in driving the statewide strike. And so there are ways that things like Facebook and Twitter can be sort of virtual gathering places for that, even as, of course, as you noted, the opponents of unions are certainly trying to use those things. And we can talk about the sort of ownership of the means of digital production, so to speak, and the corporations behind all these social media sites forever. But
Bill, how would you address Karen's question?
I'd add to what Sarah said and say that the right wing, I think, has a much better understanding of the dialectical relationship between social media and in-person organizing. That it's not that one or the other can replace one. It's that you need both. And that in-person organizing and in-person interaction is fundamental. It's fundamental in terms of building trust. You don't build trust through Facebook. You don't build trust through Twitter. You build trust looking at someone in the eyes and knowing whether they're going to watch your back. And so there's this issue of on-the-ground organizing that needs to take place through personal interaction, through social events, through re-engaging people in various activities. Yeah. You know, soccer clubs, baseball teams, et cetera, as well as the issue of social media. So both of those have to go hand in hand. And some unions and worker organizations have been successfully experimenting with this, like Our Walmart, which is workers mm-hmm. that are fighting for justice in the Walmart company, who have been utilizing social media and direct organizing.
You know, we have about 10 or so minutes left, and I'm so glad you brought this up because I want to make sure we get in a few success stories before we end. I mean, you think about especially the women at Walmart who launched that class action sexual assault lawsuit more than 10 years ago, the largest class action lawsuit we've ever seen in this country. And they have just been consistent in their protests, raising awareness. Bill, what would you say are some of the more successful movements that you've seen in the last decade or so?
Well, I mean, there's movements and there's initiatives. I mean, there's a number of things that I like to point to. So obviously, I always point to what the Chicago Teachers Union did. And I look at that as directly contributing to this effort. I think the Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movement, even though that wasn't started by organized labor, first of all, it should have been, but it wasn't. But it was nevertheless one of the most important uprisings around economic injustice that we've seen in a while, something that was directly inspired by the Madison Uprising, which itself was inspired by the Arab Spring. And so there's a number of these different efforts that I point to and I think were very important, even if they weren't entirely successful. Mm-hmm. The problem, though, is that these efforts have not gelled into a coherent front. So you have these uprisings, I'm using that term loosely, that take place, a lot of courage, sometimes incredible victories, sometimes defeats, sometimes glorious defeats. But the problem is that they don't come together the way you need a storm to come together. Mm. They exist as wind currents. Mm.
Sarah, what would you add?
Bill's making a pitch for my book right there. The thing that I'm thinking about, and I started thinking about early on when you mentioned farm workers, is Me Too, mm-hmm. which is, you know, has been a movement about work. Mm-hmm. It has been a movement about largely, but not entirely, just women at work, and the working conditions that people at all sort of levels of the working class, from Hollywood down to farm workers, have faced. And the thing, the most important intervention into that was made by the farm workers of the Alianza de Campesinas, who wrote that letter to Time magazine saying, we as farm worker women deal with rape and assault and harassment in the fields, and we see you Hollywood women who were dealing with Harvey Weinstein. We see you as workers, and they hailed them as workers in a way that it really flipped the entire conversation. Mm-hmm. And so you saw things like then the women from, you know, the women from Hollywood bringing labor organizers to the Golden Globes, bringing Ajahn Poo from the National Domestic Workers Alliance to the Golden Globes as their dates, and putting a bunch of money into organizing against sexual harassment. Mm. And I think that's a really important moment that's happened this year. It's kind of died down a little. Apparently Charlie Rose is going to make a comeback. I don't know. But I think that we had a moment where feminism was talking about work, and it was talking about work in a way that understood that your boss has a level of power over you and your body on the job. And that was a really, really important moment that broke open the discussion of work in this country.
Mm-hmm. We have time for just a couple more calls. And we did a show about farm workers about a month ago and the action against Wendy's. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. It was really interesting to hear that farm workers in Florida have really, they've really, their wages are better. They're talking about these issues in the fields. They've seen progress. Unfortunately, that has not happened in California. And it was such an interesting conversation between Florida activists and California activists talking about why that is. So you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Cookie in San Francisco. Hi, Cookie. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having this show. I just wanted to talk about the open secret in Silicon Valley and all these multi-billion dollar media companies having independent contractors do all their video services. Now, just recently, people I know at a particular company have been asked to cut their wages by half. Meanwhile, you know, the CEO is making $19 million a year, and they've had these people try to sign up with a independent company that'll contract them. So, because what these Silicon Valley companies are afraid of is, are these ICs rising up and saying, we're employees. We work there every day, 8 to 10 hours a day, like the Uber worker sued and won her case that she said she's an employee. So these ICs get no benefits, no retirement, and now it's almost impossible to sign up with this particular contracting company. They're being asked to fill out 23 different documents, buy insurance, and even when they do that, they're not fully signed up. So it's this catch-22 situation. They don't want to directly hire the ICs, but when they ask them to sign up with an independent company that'll hire them and then, you know, ferry them out to the media company, it's impossible to do that. So basically, they're trying to get these guys to just quit on their own, so they don't have to fire them, so they're not liable for anything. And this is an open secret in Silicon Valley. All these companies are doing this, and they're not paying their workers, you know. Well, they might be paying a fair wage, but if you work, you eat. If you don't, you don't.
Right.
You don't have any benefits whatsoever.
Well, this is an important point. Sarah, I heard you saying yes in the background there. I mean, you've got people also at Facebook, for example, who are contractors for $19, $20 an hour, and they've been there for a year. So in addition to Uber and Lyft drivers who are contractors, and a decision actually just came down in California that we'll talk about in a minute, you also have, you know, programmers, for example, translation experts who are contractors. So the list just keeps getting longer. What are your thoughts on that?
As an independent contractor myself, I am not surprised at all to hear that. And it's also true that in many of these cases, these people do qualify as employees. There have been successful lawsuits in several industries, including everything from port truckers to Uber drivers, as the caller mentioned. And one of the reasons to have independent contractors in the first place is to avoid the union, right? Is to avoid having all of your workers work for the company and therefore be eligible to all be in a bargaining unit should they organize. It also is to make them easier to fire, easier to get rid of, easier to cut their wages, all of those things. But a lot of that stems from them having very few protections, both under the law and of a union.
And just yesterday, the AP, I'm just reading from this piece, and a big win for labor advocates, the California Supreme Court limited businesses from classifying workers as independent contractors mm-hmm. who can't receive key employment protections. Experts expect the ruling to expand the number of workers eligible for minimum wage, rest breaks, and other benefits. This was a very big ruling. We're not really sure how it's going to play out on the ground, but Sarah, this is a big mm-hmm. ruling.
Absolutely, and this has been something that people have been looking for a while because, again, this is both subcontracting and independent contracting, and all of these are just various ways that the number of workers eligible for benefits, protections, all of these things, basically for the public-private cobbled-together thing that is the social safety net in this country, has shrunk, and the number of union members has shrunk, and all of these things. And so, right, I would encourage people who are classified as independent contractors to look into this and make sure that actually you may be an employee.
Bill, what would you say? I mean, we're here in the Bay Area, a lot of independent contractors in this area. What do you think is the most effective way for them to organize?
Well, there's two things here. One is that this is one of the central questions facing organized labor. That is, what forms of organization as well as message is necessary in order to reach workers that are not classified as employees but are classified as contractors? And I think a very positive example of approaching this is the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, mm-hmm. which is organizing workers who are explicitly classified as contractors who have no legal right to unionization. And in effect, they operate much like a union and very well organized and have thousands of members. And I think this is an example that needs to be replicated around the country. But the other thing I'd say is this, and, you know, people may bark at me when I say this, but we also have to keep in mind when we're looking at these issues that there are going to be irreconcilable differences between those of us who are workers or fighting on behalf of workers and those that are strong advocates of business when it comes to some of these matters. Because the business mentality is one of we must accumulate profits at all costs. And that if that means reducing working hours, if that means changing someone's configuration, if that means reducing the benefits, we'll do it in order to make the bottom line. The standpoint of the worker is very different. Mm-hmm. The standpoint of the worker is, I have to survive. I'm a human being. I have a right to live a decent life and my children as well. And those views clash, and there's no getting around that, and we should particularly remember that on May Day.
Mm. We should also remember the taxi drivers in New York who have committed suicide. They have either left notes or their family members said it's because of financial ruin.
Right.
And they blame Uber and Lyft. The latest one is Nicanor Ochozi. He was 65 and he hanged himself at his home in Maspeth, Queens in March of this year. Bill Fletcher is a labor writer and an organizer, author of Solidarity Divided. Sarah Jaffe is an independent journalist, author of Necessary Trouble. Bill and Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy May Day. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thank you for joining us.